hands looped behind his back, as if wondering what he thought of the situation he'd architected. People were staring, rapt and silent, at Clary and Jace. "So this is what it's like to be heroes," Emma thought, looking at the expressions on the faces of the crowd. "To be the ones with angel blood, the ones who've literally saved the world. People looked at you as if, almost as if you're not real." "Inquisitor Lightwood sent us to Faerie," Clary said, "to seek a weapon in the possession of the Unseelie King, one that would be deadly to Shadowhunters. We discovered that the Unseelie King had opened a portal to another world, one without angelic magic. He was using the earth from that other world to create the Blight you have heard of, the one eating through Brosselin Forest." "That Blight was eradicated the night before last," said Jace, "by a team of Nephilim and Fairfolk working together." Now the silence broke. There was a buzz of confused voices. "But we are not the only Nephilim working with fairies," said Clary. "The current king of Unseelie, Obon, and the cohort have been working together. It was the cohort who arranged for him to be put on the throne."
"How do we know that's true?"
shouted Joaquin Acosta Romero of the Buenos Aires Institute. He was sitting beside the French werewolf girl, his arm around her shoulders.
"Because they have done nothing but lie to you," said Mark. "They told you Jason Clary were dead. They told you fairies slaughtered them. Here they stand, alive."
"Why would the Unseelie court agree to be part of a scheme in which they were blamed for murder?" said Vivian Penhollow. Everyone looked expectantly at Julian.
"Because the cohort and the Unseelie King have already agreed on exactly what both of them will get from this parley," he said. "The parley is a performance. That is why Horus is projecting it so every Shadowhunter can see it, because the performance is more important than the outcome. If he is seen to get what he wants from the fair folk, then confidence in the cohort will grow so strong that we will never have a chance to unseat them."
Emma tried to hide a smile. "You're really back, Julian," she thought.
"This is a government that will murder its own to control its own," said Jace.
A smirk was gone from his face, and any pretense of amusement. His expression was stony and cold.
"This time, it was us. By luck, we survived and are standing here to tell you our story. The Inquisitor is meant to uphold the law, not to hide behind it as an alibi for murdering their own."
"What about murdering those who aren't Shadow Hunters?"
called a Naga sitting near some of the Keel family.
"We're against that too," said Jace.
"We've had bad members of our government before," said Julian. "But this is different. They've broken the system that might fix the situation. They're manipulating the Clave, manipulating us all. They're creating the illusion of threats to control us all through fear. They claim that fairies murdered Jace and Clary so they can declare an unjustified war. And under the cloak of that chaos, they put our consul in prison. Who could speak against the war now?"
A blonde Nephilim raised a hand.
"Oscar Lindquist here," he said. "Stockholm Institute. Are you saying we shouldn't go to Alicante? The parley is scheduled for tomorrow. If we do not arrive there tonight, we will be considered deserters, traitors."
"No," Julian said. "In fact, we need you to join the other Shadowhunters in Alicante as if everything is normal. Do nothing to alarm the cohort. The parley is going to take place on the Imperishable Fields. We, the Resistance, are going to interrupt it, with everyone watching. We will present our proof, and when that is done, we need you there to stand up for us, and hold the Clave accountable for what they've done."
"We're the proof," Jace added, indicating himself and Clary.
"I think they knew that," Emma muttered. She saw Jem in the audience give her an amused look and tensed.
"It is something so horrible that I would never repeat it. I would never do it, not under any circumstances."
She determinedly put his words out of her mind. She couldn't think about that right now.
"Why do this during the parley?" called Morena Pedroso, the head of the Rio Institute.
A bored-looking girl about Drew's age with long brown hair sat beside her.
"Why not confront them sooner?
Horace wants, no, he needs, everyone to see him triumph over the Unseelie forces, said Julian. Every shadow hunter in Idris is going to be watching him via a massive projection. There was a murmur of surprise among the downworlders. That means they'll be able to see and hear not just him, but if we join him, us. This is our chance. The cohort is bringing everyone together in a way we don't have the power to do. This is our opportunity to show all shadow hunters what the cohort truly is.
And what if it comes to battle? We'll be fighting other shadow hunters, said Oscar Lindquist. I'm sure I'm not the only one who doesn't want that.
Hopefully we can do this without a fight, said Julian. But if it comes to one, we must be ready.
So you have a plan for shadow hunters, said Hypatia Vex.
She looked over at Kit and Ty and winked. Emma wondered what that was about, but didn't have time to dwell on it.
What about us? Why did you bring downworlders here?
To witness, said Julian. We're aligned here. We're on the same side against the cohort. We know we're better, stronger, when downworlders and shadow hunters work together. And we wanted you to know that even if the cohort are loud and hateful, they're a minority. You have allies.
He glanced around the room.
A few of you will be with us. Kieran Kingson, Magnus Bane. But as for the rest of you, after the shadow hunters pass through the portals to Idris, you will need to return home to your people. Because if you don't hear from us after the parley, you can assume we were defeated. And if we are defeated, you are in danger.
We can withstand the cohort, said Neen,
and Mark looked at her in surprise.
There are many fewer of them than there are downworlders.
If we lose, it won't only be the cohort you need to fear, said Julian. Once good shadow hunters can no longer stand up to them, they will begin to destroy and control downworlders. And while they do that, there will be nobody left to stand against the tide of evil from the other worlds. They care so much about their prejudice, their imagined purity, and their laws, that they have forgotten our mandate. Protect this world from demons.
A whisper went around the room, a sound of horror.
I have seen the world overrun by demons, Emma wanted to say. There is no place there for downworlders.
We're an army, a resistance, Emma said. We are seeking justice. It won't be pretty, but it'll only get worse. The longer we wait, the more damage they'll do, and the more blood will be spilled stopping them.
Horace doesn't want a war, said Diana. He wants glory. If it looks like he's facing danger, I believe he'll back off.
If we're an army, what are we called? Said Simon.
Julian turned and unpinned the rolled-up canvas hanging on the wall behind him, which had been held in place with tacks. A gasp went up as it unfurled. Julian had painted a banner, the kind an army would carry before it in wartime. The central item was a saber, point down, painted a shimmering, pale gold.
Behind the saber spread a pair of angel's wings, while all around it clustered symbols of downworld. A star for vampires, a spellbook for warlocks, a moon for werewolves, and a four-leaf clover for fairies. Dangling from the hilt of the saber was a locket with a circle of thorns on the front.
We are called Livia's Watch, Julian said,
and Emma saw Ty sit up straighter in his chair.
We carry this banner in honor of my sister, so that all those who have been hurt by the cohort will not be forgotten.
Jace swept his gaze around the room.
If there is anyone who doesn't want to fight alongside us, they can depart now. No hard feelings.
The room was silent. Not a chair moved. Not a single person rose. Still leaning against the wall near the doors, the Iron Sister and Silent Brother, who had come to observe the proceedings, were motionless. Only Emma heard Julian's low exhale of relief.
Now, he said, let's finalize the plan.
Drew, sitting on a hillock of grass, watched as a dozen warlocks created portals on the Institute's front lawn. It certainly wasn't something she'd ever thought she was going to see. The occasional warlock or portal, sure, but not this many of them at one time. Through the portals, she could see the fields in front of the walls of Alicante. It was impossible to portal directly into the Shadowhunter city without advance permission. The closest you could get was the front gates, which was fine anyway, because the Shadowhunters needed to check in with the cohort and make sure Dearborn knew they were there. Drew was a little disappointed. She'd been hoping they'd be rushing into the city, swords flashing, but that wasn't Julian's style. If he could get what he wanted without a fight, he would. A few feet away, Tavi was humming, running an old toy car up and down a smooth-sided rock. She'd sat by herself during the meeting, though Kit had given her an encouraging smile at one point, and she had seen Julian look at her when he'd said, "Livia's watch." He looked at them all, scattered around the room. Mark and Helen, Drew and Tavi, and last of all, Ty. Drew had been worried since the night before, when Ty had come out of that weird cave by the beach. Kit had followed him and hadn't been there, as she had, to see the look on Ty's face when he'd first stepped outside. It was a hard look to explain. Half as if he might cry, and half as if he might break down, the way he sometimes did when things overwhelmed him. Livy had always been able to calm him down, but Drew didn't know if she could do the same. She was no replacement for Livy. Then Kit had come outside, and Ty's expression had changed, as if he'd realized something, and Kit seemed relieved, and Drew wanted to be relieved too. She worried about Ty when Julian had revealed the banner, and there had been Livy's locket, the one Ty wore now, curled around a saber. And when Julian had said the words, "Livia's watch," hot tears had burned the back of Drew's eyes. She felt proud, but also hollow, where the peace inside her that had been Livy had been lost to darkness. Julian stood by the sanctuary doors, speaking to the dark-haired Iron Sister who had come to the meeting. The last of the Shadowhunters were passing through the portals. Some of the Downworlders remained inside the sanctuary, avoiding the sun. Others stood and looked at the ocean and chatted among themselves. Maris Lightwood stood by the portal Magnus had created, smiling as she watched Max and Rafe run in circles around Alec. Rocks and sand crunched. Drew looked up and saw Julian standing over her, silhouetted by the sun. "Hey, kiddo," he said.
"What's going on with the Iron Sisters and Silent Brothers?" said Drew. "Are they on our side?"
"The Iron Sisters have already rejected the cohort," said Julian. "They're backing us up. Sister Amelia even had a good idea about the mortal sword. The Silent Brothers are, well, not neutral. They don't like the cohort either, but any defection on their part will be more obvious and might tip our hand. They're going to station themselves in Alicante to keep an eye on things and prevent the cohort from getting suspicious." This was one of the things Drew loved about Julian. He didn't talk down to her, not even about strategy.
"Speaking of Alicante," she said, "it's time for us to go, huh?"
She'd known this was coming. Julian had told her about it before the meeting. She'd thought she'd be all right with it, considering that she wanted to get into Alicante, and this was pretty much the only way that was going to happen. Not that Julian knew that. She screwed her face into a woeful expression.
"I don't see why you have to leave us behind."
"I'm not leaving you behind," Julian said. "I'm sending you ahead. You are part of Livia's watch. Don't forget it." Drew continued to scowl. Tavi was still playing with his car, but he was also watching them out of the corner of his eye.
"Semantics are nobody's friend."
Julian knelt down in front of her. Drew was surprised. She wouldn't have thought he'd want to get his knees dirty when he was wearing nice clothes, but apparently he didn't care. "Drew," he said, "I can't leave you here. It isn't safe. And I can't take you where we're going. There could be a battle, a big one."
"I can fight," Drew said.
Julian put his fingers under her chin and lifted her face so that she was looking directly at him. She wondered if this was what it was like for most kids to look at their parents. This was the face she associated with praise and scoldings, with late-night nightmare assistance and hot chocolate when it was needed, and band-aids when those were called for.
Julian had held her hand through the application of her first marks. He was the one who stuck her terrible drawings to the fridge with magnets. He never forgot a birthday. And he was still a kid himself. It was the first time she'd been able to look at him and see it. He was young, younger than Jace and Clary or Alec and Magnus. And yet he'd stood up in front of that sanctuary full of people and told them what they were going to do, and they'd listened.
"I know you can fight," he said. "But if I think you're in danger, I don't know if I can."
"What about Kit and Ty?"
He grinned at her. "Don't tell them, but Magnus promised to make sure they don't get near the actual battle."
Drew gave a reluctant smile. "It's going to suck not knowing if you guys are okay."
"We'll all be wearing Familius runes," said Julian. "Tavi too, so that's something. If you need to know how one of us is, activate yours."
His eyes darkened. "Drew, you know I'd protect you to my last breath, right? I'd give my last drop of blood for you. So would Emma."
"I know," Drew said. "I love you too."
He pulled her into a quick hug, then stood up and offered his hand. She let him pull her to her feet and dusted herself off as he picked up Tavi. She trailed along behind the two of them as they headed toward Maris, Max, and Rafe. She didn't want to look as if she were in any way eager to go to Alicante. She felt a little bad about deceiving Julian, but if there was anything she'd learned from Kit and Ty in the past weeks, it was that sometimes you had to trick a trickster at his own game.
"But why are the small ones going?" said Gwyn, as Diana stood watching Max, then Rafe, then Tavi pass through the portal to Alicante. "It was my understanding that Julian wished to keep them all together." Diana sighed and slipped her hand into Gwyn's.
"It's because he loves them that he's sending them away. Battle is no place for a child."
"We have children in the Wild Hunt, as young as 8 years sometimes," said Gwyn.
"Yes, but we've also covered how that's a bad thing, Gwyn."
"Sometimes I forget all the lessons you teach me," said Gwyn, but he sounded amused.
Drew was just stepping through the portal to Alicante. She turned at the last moment and looked back at Julian. Diana saw him nod encouragingly as Drew stepped into the whirlwind and was gone.
"It is not certain there will be a battle, either."
"It is not certain there won't be," Diana said. Julian had turned away from the portal. The encouraging look he'd worn for Drew and Tavi was gone, and he looked hollow and sad. He headed toward the Institute doors.
"The false faces we wear for the ones we love," Diana thought. "Julian would bleed out for these children and never ask for a bandage, in fear that the question would upset them."
"The children will be safe with Maris, and not being frightened for them will free up Julian and the rest of us to do what we need to do."
"And what is it you need to do?"
Diana tipped her head back and looked up at Gwyn.
"Be warriors."
Gwyn touched a curl of her hair.
"You are a warrior every day."
Diana smiled. Julian had reached the sanctuary doors and turned there, looking out on the group in front of the Institute, a motley collection of warlocks, shadow hunters, and a group of werewolves playing hacky sack.
"Time to come in," he said, his voice carrying over the sound of the sea. "The real meeting's about to start."
From the window of the guard, Manuel could see shadow hunters streaming in through the great gate, the main entrance to the city of Alicante. All the exits were guarded now and warded against the imaginary threat of encroaching unseelie fairies.
"It does not seem the Blackthorns' meeting was a success," said Horace. He could see out the window from the Inquisitor's big desk. It was odd, Manuel thought. He still didn't think of Horace as the Inquisitor. Perhaps because he never really cared who the Inquisitor or the Consul was. They were positions of power and therefore desirable, but they held no inherent meaning.
"The families he invited to his little insurrection are still arriving."
Zara entered without knocking, as was her usual style. She wore her Centaurian gear, as she always did. Manuel found it pretentious.
The Rosewaynes are here, and the Keos, and the Rosaleses. She was fuming. They all arrived at once, through portals. It's like they're not even trying to hide it.
Oh, I don't know, said Manuel.
If we hadn't been tipped off about the meeting, I don't think we'd have noticed. Too many people coming and going.
Don't compliment Julian Blackthorne, said Zara, scowling. He's a traitor.
Oh, clearly, said Manuel. But now we get to punish them, which I'm going to enjoy.
I'm sure you are, Zara gave him a superior look, but Manuel knew she was going to enjoy the punishment of the Blackthorns just as much as he was.
They both hated Emma. Of course, Manuel had good reason. She'd shown him disrespect at the last council hall meeting, while Zara was merely jealous.
We'll make an example of them, said Horace, after the parley. Not the younger Blackthorns. No one likes to see a child die, even if the seeds of evil are in them. But Julian, certainly, and that half-breed brother and sister of his. The Carstairs girl, of course. Aline Penhallow is a tricky question.
The door opened. Manuel looked around curiously. There was only one other visitor to Horace's office who, like Zara, never bothered knocking. A tall, blonde shadow hunter stepped into the room. Manuel had seen him earlier, coming through the great gate. Oscar Lindquist, having separated himself from the rest of his equally blonde family. Horace glanced up. His eyes glittered.
Shut the door behind you.
Oscar made a sound between a growl and a laugh, closing and locking the office door. There was a slight shimmer in the air as he turned and began to change. It was like watching water spill over a painting, distorting and altering the lines of it. Zara made a low noise of disgust as Oscar's head fell back and his body spasmed, his hair turning a dark brownish black and falling to spill over his shoulders, his spine compacting as he shrank down into a smaller frame, the lines of his jaw softening into a new, familiar outline. Annabelle Blackthorne looked at them out of steady, blue-green eyes.
So, how is the meeting? Horace said. We surmised it hadn't gone well, considering the number of shadow hunters returning to Idris.
I believe it went as intended. Horace wrinkled his brow as Annabelle sat stiffly in a chair opposite his desk. Zara watched her warily. Horace kept referring to Annabelle as the Unseelie King's gift to him, but perhaps Zara didn't consider it a gift.
Except for the fact that I was there.
No one guessed you weren't Oscar, said Zara.
Obviously not.
Annabelle was studying her hands as if they were unfamiliar to her. Her plan is simple to the point of rudimentary, which could be seen as an advantage, less to go wrong. Horace leaned forward, arms resting on his desk.
Are you saying we should be worried?
No,
Annabelle said, touching the etched glass vial at her throat thoughtfully. Red liquid swirled within it. The element of surprise was their only advantage. Foolish of them to assume they would not be betrayed. She sat back in her chair.
Let us begin with the basics. Jace Herondale and Clary Fairchild are still alive.
Emma stood at the doorway of the Institute. The last of the Downworlders had gone, and they would all be leaving for Broslin soon. Brother Shadrach had assured Julian and the others that all the guards in Idris had been recalled to the city for the parley. The forest would be deserted. The afternoon sun glimmered on the sea, and distantly she wondered if, after today, she would ever see the Pacific Ocean again. Long ago, her father had told her that the lights that danced on the surface of seawater came from glowing jewels beneath, and that if you reached under the surface, you could catch a jewel in your hand. She held her hand out in front of her now, palm up, and thought of Jem's words. And then, of Diana's. The runes began to burn like fire, as if they had fire in their veins instead of blood. Black lines spread over their bodies, and they became monstrous, physically monstrous.
Across the inside of her forearm, where the skin had been pale and smooth, was a dark webbing of black lines, like cracks in marble, nearly the size of the palm of her hand. Part 3. Lady Vengeance. Her strong enchantments failing, her towers of fear and wreck, her limbics dried of poisons, and the knife at her neck. The queen of air and darkness begins to shrill and cry, "Oh, young man, oh, my slayer, tomorrow you shall die." "Oh, queen of air and darkness, I think 'tis truth, you say. And I shall die tomorrow, but you will die today." A. E. Houseman. Her strong enchantments failing. Chapter 28. And Shadows There. It was cool in Brosland Forest. Encroaching autumn added a cold metal bite to the air that Emma could taste on her tongue. Quiet had come suddenly after the rush of portal travel, the setting up of tents in the cleared space among the ancient trees and green earth. They were far from the blighted areas, Diana promised them. In the distance, over the tops of the trees, Emma could see the glimmer of the demon towers of Alicante. She stood on a rise overlooking where they'd made camp. There were about a dozen tents set up in rows, each with two torches burning in front of its flap door. They were cozy inside, with thick rugs on the floor and even blankets. Alec had given Magnus a sharp sideways look when they'd appeared out of nowhere. "I did not steal them," Magnus had said, looking studiously at his fingernails. "I borrowed them." "So you'll be returning them to the camping store?" said Alec, hands on his hips. "I actually got them from a warehouse that provides props for movies," said Magnus. "It'll be ages before anyone notices they're gone. Not," he added hastily, "that I won't be returning them, of course. Everyone, try not to set your tents on fire. They're not our property."
"Does one normally set them on fire?" said Kieran, who had his own tent. Mark and Julian were sharing one, and Emma was sharing another with Christina. "Is that a tradition?"
Mark and Christina both smiled at him. The oddness going on with the three of them was growing more intense, Emma thought, and resolved to ask Christina about it. The opportunity came sooner than she'd thought it would. She'd been restless inside the tent alone. Christina was helping Aline and Julian, who'd put themselves in charge of cooking dinner. Everyone was muttering around maps and plans except Jace, who'd fallen conspicuously asleep with his head in Clary's lap. Emma couldn't concentrate. Her body and mind hummed with energy. All she wanted was to talk to Julian. She knew she couldn't, but the need to tell him everything was painful. She'd never made such a life-altering decision without telling him before. She'd ended up throwing on a sweater and taking a walk around the perimeter of the camp. The air smelled so different here than it did at home. Pine, green woods, campfire smoke. Inland, no scent of salt or sea. She climbed a small rocky rise over the camp and gazed down. Tomorrow they would ride out to challenge Horace Dearborn and his cohort. Very likely there would be a confrontation. And her Parapetai, the one who always fought by her side, would be lost to her, one way or another. The sun was setting, sparking off the distant shimmer of the demon towers. Emma could hear the night birds chirping in the woods nearby and tried not to think about what else was in the forest. She felt herself shivering. No, she was shaking. She felt disoriented, almost dizzy, and her cognitive process felt strangely diffuse, as if her mind were racing too fast for her to concentrate. "Emma!" Christina was walking up the rise toward her, her dark eyes full of concern. "I looked for you in the tent, but you weren't there. Are you all right? Or are you on watch?"
"Pull yourself together, Emma."
"I just thought someone should try to keep an eye on things, you know, in case a party of cohort members decides to take a closer look at Brosland." "So you're on watch," said Christina.
"Maybe," Emma said.
What's going on with you and Kieran and Mark?
Aye, Christina sat down on a rock, knocking her forehead gently against her hand.
Really? Now?
Emma sat down next to her friend. We don't have to talk about it if you don't want to. She pointed her index finger at Christina. If we both die in battle tomorrow, though, we'll never get to talk about it ever. And you'll never get the benefit of my enormous wisdom.
Look at this crazy girl, Christina said, gesturing to an invisible audience. All right. What makes you think anything new is happening anyway?
I see it in the way you look at each other. I've never seen anything like it, Emma said.
Christina sobered immediately, her hand going to the angel medallion at her throat, as it often did when she was nervous.
I don't know what to do, she said. I love both of them. I love Mark and I love Kieran. I love them both in different ways, but with no less intensity.
Emma spoke carefully. Are they asking you to choose between them? Christina looked off toward the sunset, stripes of gold and red above the trees.
No. No, they are not asking me to choose.
I see, said Emma, who was not sure she did see. Then
we decided it was impossible, Christina said. Kieran, Mark, and I, we are all afraid. If we were together the way we want to be, we would bring misery on those we love.
Misery? Why? Emma's hands were shaking again. She shoved them between her knees so Christina wouldn't see.
Kieran fears for Fairy, Christina said. After so many terrible kings, after so much cruelty, he wishes to go back and take up a place in the court and see to the welfare of his people. He cannot turn away from that, and neither Mark nor I would want him to. But for us, we cannot know the future. Even if the cohort is gone, it does not mean the end of the Cold Peace. Mark is afraid for Helen, for all of the Blackthorns, that if he were involved with the Prince of Faerie and everyone knew it, his family would be punished. I fear the same for my family, so it would never work. Do you understand?
Emma twirled a piece of grass between her fingers.
I would never judge you, she said.
First because it's you, and second because I hardly have the right to judge anyone.
But I think you're letting your fear get in the way of what you really want, because what you really want is what you're afraid of.
Christina blinked.
What do you mean?
From the outside, here's what I see, said Emma. When Mark and Kieran are alone together, they get pulled into their difficult past. It consumes them. When Mark and you are together, he worries that he isn't good enough for you, no matter what you say. And when Kieran and you are together, sometimes you can't bridge the gulf between Shadowhunter understanding and Fairy understanding. Mark helps you bridge that gulf.
The sun was nearly down, the sky a deep blue, Christina's expression lost in shadow. Does that seem wrong?
No, Christina said after a long pause.
But it doesn't.
You're afraid of what everyone is afraid of, said Emma. Having your hearts broken, being made miserable by love.
But what you're saying, that's what the cohort wants. They want to make people afraid, to make them stay apart because they have created an environment of fear and suspicion where you can be punished for being with someone you love. If they got their way, they'd punish Alec for being with Magnus. But that doesn't mean Magnus and Alec should split up. Am I making sense?
A little too much sense, Christina said, pulling at a loose thread on her sleeve.
I know one thing for sure, Emma said. Christina, of all the people I know, you are the most generous, and you spend the most time thinking about what makes other people happy.
I think you should do whatever makes you happy. You deserve it.
Thanks, Christina gave her a shaky smile. What about you and Julian? How are you doing?
Emma's stomach lurched, surprising her. It was as if hearing the words, you and Julian, had set something off inside her. She pushed down on the feeling, trying to control it.
It's really hard, she whispered.
Julian and I can't even talk to each other. And the best we can hope for after all this is over is some kind of exile.
I know.
Christina took Emma's hand in hers. Emma tried to still her own shaking. Christina's reassuring touch helped. For the millionth time, Emma wished she'd met Christina earlier, that Christina could have been her parabatai.
After the exile, if it happens, come stay with me, wherever I am, Mexico, anywhere. I'll take care of you.
Emma made a sound halfway between a laugh and a sniffle. That's what I mean. You're always doing things for other people, Tina.
Okay, well, then I'm going to ask you to do something for me.
What? I'll do anything. Unless it makes your mom mad. Your mom scares me.
You want to kill Zara in the battle, if there's a fight, don't you? Christina said. The thought had crossed my mind.
Okay, yes. If anyone else takes her out, I'm going to be really angry. Emma mock scowled. Christina sighed.
We don't even know if there's going to be a fight, Emma. If Zara is spared or imprisoned or escapes, or if someone else kills her, I don't want you to dwell on it. Revenge only comes back to hurt you. Focus on what you want your life to be after tomorrow.
After tomorrow, I'll be exiled, Emma thought.
Will I see you again, Christina? Will I always miss you?
Christina narrowed her eyes in concern. Emma, promise me. But before Emma could promise, before she could say anything at all, Aline's and Helen's voices cut through the evening air, calling them down to dinner.
Has anyone ever tried ketchup on a s'more? Isabel said.
This is why you're a bad cook, said Alec.
Simon, bundled up in a sweater and leaning back against a log, slunk down as if he hoped to become invisible.
You actually like disgusting food. It's not like an accident.
I like ketchup and s'mores, said Simon loyally and mouthed to Clary. I don't like them.
I know, Clary said. I can feel through the parabatai bond how much you don't like them.
Julian is an excellent cook, said Emma, spearing a marshmallow.
Magnus had produced bags of them along with the requisite chocolate and graham crackers. He gave Emma a dark look that seemed to say, stay away from Julian and also his cooking.
I am also an excellent cook, said Mark, putting an acorn on his s'more.
Everyone stared.
He can't help it, said Christina loyally. He has lived in the Wild Hunt for so long.
I don't do that, said Kieran, eating a s'more in the correct fashion. Mark has no excuse.
I never pictured shadow hunters eating s'mores, said Kit, glancing around the fire. It was like a scene out of dreams of camping that he'd had when he was a little kid. The fire, the trees, everyone bundled up in sweaters and sitting around on logs, smoke in their eyes and hair. On the other hand, this is the first s'more I've ever had that didn't come out of a box.
That's not a s'more then, Ty said. That's a cookie, or some cereal.
Kit smiled, and Ty smiled back at him. He leaned against Julian, who was sitting beside him. Julian put an absent arm around his younger brother, his hand ruffling Ty's hair.
Excited for your first battle? Jace said to Kit. Jace was sitting cross-legged with his arms around Clary, who was creating a massive s'more out of several chocolate bars.
He's not going, Clary said. He's too young, Jace.
She looked at Kit.
Don't listen to him.
He seems old enough, said Jace. I was fighting battles when I was 10.
Stay away from my children, said Magnus. I'm watching you, Herondale.
Kit felt a brief jolt before realizing Magnus wasn't talking to him. Then another when he realized he'd reacted unconsciously to the name Herondale.
This is great, said Helen, yawning.
I haven't been camping in so long. You can't go camping on Wrangell Island. Your fingers will turn to icicles and snap right off. Emma frowned.
Where's Christina?
Kit glanced around. Emma was right. Christina had slipped away from the group.
She shouldn't be walking around the edge of the forest, Magnus said, frowning. There are booby traps there. Quite well hidden, if I do say so myself.
He started to rise. I'll get her. Mark and Kieran were already on their feet.
We'll find her, Mark said hastily. In the hunt, we learned much about traps.
A few know more about the ways of the forest than the Fae, said Kieran.
Magnus shrugged, but there was a knowing spark in his eye that Kit didn't quite understand.
All right, go ahead.
As they vanished into the shadows, Emma smiled and placed another marshmallow on a stick.
Let's make a toast, Aline raised a plastic cup of water. To never being parted from our families again, she gazed at the fire. Once tomorrow comes, we're never going to let the Clave do that to any of us again.
Not to be parted from family or friends, said Helen, raising her glass.
Or Parabatai, said Simon, winking at Clary.
Alec and Jace cheered, but Julian and Emma were silent. Emma seemed bleakly sad, staring down into her cup of water. She did not seem to see Julian, who looked at her for a single long moment before wrenching his gaze away.
To never being parted, Kit said, looking across the campfire at Ty.
Ty's thin face was limned in light from the red-gold flames. To never being parted, he said, with a grave emphasis that made Kit shiver for reasons that he did not understand.
Maris could no longer return to the Inquisitor's house, as Horace and Zara had moved into it. Instead, she took Drew and the others to the Greymark house, the one Clary said she had stayed in when she'd first come to Idris. Drew had gone to bed as soon as she politely could. She lay with the covers tucked up to her chin, looking at the last bits of sunlight fading from the circular windows. This side of the house faced onto a garden full of roses, the color of old lace. The trellis climbed to the windows and circled them. At the height of summer, they probably looked like necklaces of roses. Houses of old stone fell away down the hill toward the walls of Alicante, walls that tomorrow would be lined with shadow hunters facing the imperishable fields. Drew burrowed farther under the covers. She could hear Maris in the next room singing to Max and Rafe and Tavi, a lilting song in French. It was strange to be too old for singing to comfort you, but too young to take part in battle preparations. She started to say their names to herself as a sort of good luck charm. Jules and Emma, Mark and Helen, Ty and Liv... No, not Livy. The singing had stopped. Drew heard footsteps in the hall and a door open. Maris stuck her head in.
Is everything all right, Drusilla? Do you need anything?
Drew would have liked a glass of water, but she didn't know exactly how to talk to Max and Rafe's imposing, dark-haired grandmother. She'd heard Maris playing with Tavi earlier, and she appreciated how kind this woman, who was basically a stranger, was being to them. She just wished she knew how to say it.
No, that's okay, Drew said. I don't need anything.
Maris leaned against the door jamb.
I know it's hard, she said.
When I was young, my parents always used to take my brother Max with them to hunt demons and leave me alone at home. They said I'd be frightened if I went with them. I always tried to tell them I was more frightened worrying they'd never come back. Drew tried to picture Maris young and couldn't quite. She seemed old to Drew to even be a mom, though she knew she wasn't. She was actually quite a young grandmother, but Drew had gotten used to people who looked like Julian and Helen being like mothers and fathers to her.
They always did come back, though, Maris said. And so will your family. I know it feels like what Julian is doing is risky, but he's smart. Horace won't try anything dangerous in front of so many people.
I should go to sleep,
Drew said in a small voice, and Maris sighed, giving her an understanding nod and closed the door. If she were home, a small voice said in the back of Drew's mind, she wouldn't have had to ask for anything. Helen, who knew she loved tea, but that the caffeine kept her up, would have come in with a mug of the special decaffeinated blend they'd bought in England, with milk and honey in the mug, the way Drew liked it. She missed Helen, Drew realized. It was a weird feeling. Somewhere along the way, her resentment toward Helen had vanished. Now she just wished she'd said a better goodbye to her older sister before she'd left the Institute. Maybe it was better she hadn't said the right kind of goodbyes to her family. Maybe it meant she was definitely going to see them again. Maybe it meant they'd be more forgiving when they found out what she was planning to do.
The light blinked out in the hall. Maris must be going to sleep. Drew threw off the blanket. She was fully dressed underneath, down to her boots and gear jacket. She slid off the bed and went over to the circular window. It was stuck shut, but she'd been expecting that. Taking a small dagger with an adamas blade out of her pocket, she started to jimmy it open. Kit lay awake in the darkness, counting the stars he could see through the open flap of the tent. Emma and Julian had said the stars in Faerie were different, but here in Idris they were the same. The same constellations he had looked at all his life, peeking through the smog above Los Angeles, shone above Broslyn Forest. The air was clear here, clear as cut crystal, and the stars seemed almost alarmingly close, as if he could reach out and catch one in his hand. Ty hadn't come back with him from the campfire. Kit didn't know where he was. Had he gone to talk to Jules or Helen? Was he wandering in the forest? No, Simon and Isabel would have stopped him. But maybe Ty had found an animal he liked in the campsite. Kit's mind started to race. Where is he? Why didn't he take me with him? What if he can't tame these squirrels the way he can the ones at home? What if he's attacked by squirrels? With a groan, Kit kicked off his covers and reached for a jacket. Ty stuck his head into the tent, momentarily blotting out the stars. Oh, good. You're already getting ready. Kit lowered his voice. What do you mean I'm getting ready? Ready for what? Ty dropped into a crouch and peered into the tent. To go to the lake. Ty, said Kit, I need you to explain. Don't assume I know what you're talking about. Ty exhaled with enough force to make his dark fringe of hair flutter above his forehead. I brought the spell with me, and all the ingredients, he said. The best place to raise the dead is by the water. I thought we'd do it next to the ocean, but Lake Lynn's even better. It's already a magical place. Kit blinked dizzily. He felt as if he'd woken up from a nightmare, only to discover he was still dreaming. But we don't have what we need to make the spell work. Shade never gave us a catalyst. I thought he might not do it, said Ty. That's why I picked up an alternate energy source last time we were at the Shadow Market. He reached into his pocket and took out a clear glass ball the size of an apricot. Red-orange flame blazed inside it, as if it were a small fiery planet, though it was clearly cool to the touch. Kit jerked back. Where'd that come from? I told you, the Shadow Market. Kit felt a wave of panic. Who sold that to you? How do we even know it'll work? It has to. Ty slipped the crystal back into his pocket. Kit, this is something I have to do. If there's a battle tomorrow, you know we're not going to be part of it. They think we're too young to fight. This is the way I can help that isn't fighting. If I bring Livy back, our family will be whole for the battle. It will mean that everyone will be happy again. But happiness isn't that simple, Kit wanted to cry. You can't rip it apart and put it back together again without seeing the seams. Kit's voice was ragged. It's dangerous, Ty. It's too dangerous. I don't think it's a good idea to mess around with this kind of magic, with an unknown power source. Ty's expression closed down. It was like watching a door shut. I've already scouted for traps. I know how we can get there. I thought you would come with me, but even if you don't, I'm going alone. Kit's mind raced. I could wake up the camp and get Ty in trouble, he thought. Julian would stop him, I know he would. But Kit's whole mind revolted at the idea. If there was one thing his father had brought him up to understand, it was that everyone hated a snitch. And besides, he couldn't bear to look at Ty's face. All right, Kit said, feeling dread settle in his stomach like a rock. I'll go with you. Shapes danced in the heart of the fire. Emma sat on a log nearby, her hands thrust into the sleeves of her oversized sweater to keep them warm. The group had drifted away from the fire when the meal was done, retiring to their individual tents to sleep. Emma stayed where she was, watching the fire die down. She supposed she could have gone back to her own tent, but Christina wasn't there, and Emma didn't feel much like lying alone in the dark. She glanced up as a shadow approached,
It was Julian. She recognized him by the way he walked, even before the firelight illuminated his face. Hand in his pocket, his shoulders relaxed and his chin upturned. Deceptively casual. The damp in the cool air had curled his hair against his cheeks and temples. Julian hid so many things from so many people. Now, for the first time, she was hiding something from him. Was this how he always felt? The weight in his chest? The pinching pain at his heart? She half expected him to pass her by without speaking, but he paused, his fingers toying with the sea glass bracelet on his wrist. "Are you all right?" he asked, his voice low. Emma nodded. Sparks from the fire reflected in Julian's blue eyes. "I know we shouldn't talk to each other," he said. "But we need to discuss something with someone. It's not about you or me."
"I can't do it," Emma thought. "You don't understand. You still think we could get my marks stripped if things went wrong."
But then again, her rune hadn't burned since they'd left Los Angeles. The black webbing on her forearm hadn't grown. It was as if her misery were holding the curse back. Maybe it was. "Who's it about?" "It's about one of the things we learned in Thule," he said. "It's about Diana." Diana woke from dreams of flying to the sound of scratching at the door of her tent. She rolled out of her blankets and caught up a knife, rising to a crouch. She heard the sound of two voices, one rising over the other.
"Octopus."
She had a vague memory that this was the code word they had all chosen earlier. She put her knife away and went to unzip the flap of the tent. Emma and Julian stood on the other side, blinking in the dark, pale and wide-eyed like startled meerkats. Diana raised her eyebrows at them. "Well, if you want to come in, come in. Don't just stand there letting all the cold air in." The tents were just high enough to stand up in, unfurnished by anything but rugs and bedding. Diana sank back into the nest of her covers while Julian leaned against her pack and Emma sat cross-legged on the floor.
"Sorry for waking you up," said Julian, ever the diplomat. "We didn't know when else we might get to talk to you."
She couldn't help yawning. Diana always slept surprisingly well the night before a battle. She knew shadow hunters who couldn't get sleep, who stayed awake with pounding hearts, but she wasn't one of them.
"Talk to me about what?"
"I want to apologize," Julian said, as Emma worried at the frayed knee of her jeans.
Emma didn't seem like herself. Hadn't for a while now, Diana thought. Not since they'd come back from that other world, though an experience like that would change anyone.
"For pushing you to be the head of the Institute."
Diana narrowed her eyes.
"What brought this on?"
"The Thule version of you told us about your time in Bangkok," Emma said, biting her lip. "But you don't have to talk about anything to us if you don't want to." Diana's first reaction was a reflex.
"No, I don't want to talk about this, not now. Not on the eve of a battle, not with so much on her mind, not while she was worrying about Gwyn and trying not to think about where he was or what he might do tomorrow." And yet, she'd been on her way to tell Emma and Julian precisely what they were asking about now, when she'd found out she couldn't reach them. She recalled her disappointment. She'd been determined then. She didn't owe them the story, but she owed it to herself to tell it. They both sat quietly, looking at her. The night before a battle, and they had come to her for this. Not for reassurance, but to let her know it was her choice to engage or not to. She cleared her throat.
"So you know I'm transgender. Do you know what that means?" Julian said, "We know that when you were born, you were assigned a gender that does not reflect who you actually are."
Something in Diana loosened. She laughed. "Someone's been on the internet," she said.
"Yeah, that's right, more or less." "And when you were in Bangkok, you used mundane medicine," said Emma, "to become who you really are."
"Baby girl, I've always been who I really am," said Diana.
"In Bangkok, Katerina Loss helped me find doctors who would change my body to represent who I am, and people who were like me, to help me understand I wasn't alone." She settled back against the rolled-up jacket she'd been using as a pillow. "Let me tell you the story."
And, in a quiet voice, she did.
She didn't vary the telling much from the story she'd told Gwyn, because that story had eased her heart. She watched their expressions as she spoke. Julian, calm and silent. Emma reacting to every word with widened eyes or bitten lips. They'd always been like this. Emma expressing what Julian couldn't or wouldn't. So alike and so different. But it was Julian who spoke first when she was finished.
"I'm sorry about your sister," he said. "I'm so sorry."
She looked at him in a little surprise. But then, of course, that would be what would strike a chord with Jules, wouldn't it? In some ways, the hardest part of any of it was not being able to talk about Arya, she said.
"Gwyn knows, right?" Emma said. "And he was good about it? He's kind to you, right?"
She sounded as fierce as Diana had ever heard her.
"He is, I promise," Diana said.
For someone who reaps the dead, he's surprisingly empathic.
"We won't tell anyone unless you want us to," Emma said. "It's your business."
"I worry that they find out about my medical treatment if I ever try to become institute head," said Diana. "That I'd be taken away from you children, punished with exile." Her hands tightened in her lap. "But the Inquisitor found out anyway."
Emma sat up straight. "He did? When?"
"Before I fled Idris. He threatened to expose me to everyone as a traitor."
"He is such a bastard," Julian said. His face was tight.
"Are you angry with me," Diana said, "for not telling you before?"
"No," Julian said, his voice quiet and firm. "You had no obligation to do that. Not ever."
Emma scooted closer to Diana, her hair a pale halo in the moonlight streaming through the tent flap.
"Diana, these past 5 years, you've been the closest thing I've had to an older sister. And since I met you, you've shown me the kind of woman I want to grow up to be."
She reached out and took Diana's hand.
"I feel so grateful and so privileged that you wanted to tell us your story."
"Agreed," said Julian. He bent his head like a knight acknowledging a lady in an old painting. "I'm sorry I pushed you. I didn't understand. I thought of you as an adult, someone who couldn't possibly have problems or be in any danger. I was so focused on the kids that I didn't realize you were all so vulnerable."
Diana touched his hair lightly, the way she often had when he was younger.
"That's growing up, isn't it? Figuring out that adults are people with their own issues and secrets." She smiled wryly as Helen stuck her head in through the still unzipped flap.
"Oh, good, you're up," she said. "I wanted to go over who's staying behind tomorrow."
"I've got a list," Julian said, sliding his hand into the pocket of his jacket. Emma got to her feet, murmuring that she needed to go find Christina. She slipped out the door of the tent, stopping only to glance back once at Julian as she went, but he was deep in conversation with Helen and didn't seem to notice. Something was going on with that girl, Diana thought. Once they'd gotten through tomorrow, she'd have to find out what it was.
Chapter 29. Tempt the Waters.
"Christina!
Christina!"
Voices rang through the woods below.
Surprised, Christina stood up, peering down into the darkness. It had been too painful at the campfire, looking at Mark and at Kieran. Knowing she was counting down hours until one or both of them left her life forever. She had slipped away to sit among the trees and grass and shadows of Brosland. There were white flowers here, among the green, native to Idris. She had seen them before only in pictures, and to touch their petals gave her a feeling of peace, though her sorrow remained beneath it. Then she heard the voices, Mark and Kieran, calling for her. She had been sitting at the top of a green rise of grass between the trees. She rose, brushed herself off, and hurried down the hill toward the sound of her name.
"Estoy aquí,"
she called, nearly tripping as she rushed down the hill.
"I'm right here."
They burst from the shadows, both white-faced. Mark found her first and swung her up off her feet, hugging her tightly. After a moment, he released her to Kieran's arms as they tried to explain.
something about Magnus and traps and being afraid she'd fallen into a pit lined with knives.
I would never do that,
she protested as Kieran stroked her hair back from her face.
Mark, Kieran, I think we were wrong.
Kieran let her go immediately.
Wrong about what?
Mark was standing next to Kieran, their shoulders just brushing. Her boys, Christina thought, the ones she loved. She could not choose between them any more than she could choose between night and day, nor did she wish to.
Wrong that it's impossible, she said. I should have said it before. I was afraid. I did not want to be hurt. Isn't that what we all fear? That we would be hurt? We keep our hearts in prison, in terror that if we let them go free in the world, they would be injured. But I do not want to be in prison. And I think you feel the same. But if you do not...
In his soft, husky voice, Mark said,
I love both of you, and I could not say I love one of you the most. But I am afraid. The loss of both of you would kill me. And here it seems I'm risking having my heart broken, not once, but twice. Not all love ends in heartbreak, said Christina.
You know what I want, Kieran said. I was the one to say it first. I love and desire you both. Many are happy like this in Faerie. It is common, such marriages.
Are you proposing to us? Said Mark with a crooked grin, and Kieran turned bright red.
There is one thing, he said. The King of Faerie can have no human consort. You both know that.
It doesn't matter right now, Christina said fiercely. You're not king yet, and if you ever are, we will find a way.
Mark inclined his head, a Faerie gesture.
As Christina says.
My heart goes with her words, Kieran.
I want to be with you both, said Christina. I want to be able to kiss you both and to hold you both. I want to be able to touch you both, sometimes at the same time, sometimes when we are just two. I want you to be able to kiss and hold each other because it makes you happy, and I want you to be happy. I want us to be together, all three.
I think of each of you all the time. I long for you when you are not there. The words seemed to burst from Kieran like undammed water. He touched Mark's face with his long boned fingers, light as the brush of wind on grass. He turned to Christina next and, with his other hand, caressed her cheek. She could feel that he was shaking. She put her hand over his, pressing it to her face.
I have never wanted anything so desperately as this.
Mark placed his own hand over Kieran's.
I too. I believe in this, in us. Love wakens love. Faith wakens faith.
He smiled at Christina.
All this time we were waiting for you. We loved each other, and it was a great thing, but with you, it is even greater.
Kiss me then, Christina whispered, and Mark pulled her close and kissed her warmly, then hotly. Kieran's hands were on her back, in her hair. She leaned her head against him as he and Mark kissed over her shoulder, their bodies cradling hers, their hands linked in each other's. Kieran was smiling like his face would break. They were all kissing each other and laughing with happiness and touching each other's faces with wondering fingers.
I love you,
Christina said to both of them, and they said it back to her at the same time, their voices mingling so she was not sure who spoke first or last.
I love you, I love you, I love you.
Kit had seen Lake Lynn before in pictures. The endless images of the angel rising out of it with the mortal instruments that were inside every Shadow Hunter building, on every wall and tapestry. It was a different thing entirely in real life. It moved like an oil slick under the moonlight. The surface was silver-black, but shot through with bursts of chromatic splendor, streaks of violet blue and hot red, ice green and bruised violet. For the first time when Kit imagined the angel Raziel, massive and blank-faced, rising out of the water, he felt a shiver of awe and fear. Ty had set up his ceremonial circle by the edge of the lake, where the water lapped at a shallow sandy beach. It was actually two circles, one smaller within another larger, and in the border between the circles, Ty had etched dozens of runes with a pointed stick. Kit had seen ceremonial circles before, often in his own living room. But how had Ty become an expert at making them? His circles were neater than Johnny's had ever been, his etchings more careful. He wasn't using Shadowhunter runes, but a runic language that looked far spikier and more unpleasant. Was this where Ty had gone all those times Kit had turned around to find him gone, learning how to be a dark magician? Ty had also set up their ingredients in neat rows beside him, the myrrh, the chalk, Libby's baby tooth, the letter from Thule. Kit wasn't sure if they were arranged in a ceremonial order or if they were just in the order Ty preferred. Having placed the velvet bag containing a lock of Libby's hair carefully among the other objects, Ty looked up at Kit, who was standing close to the water's edge. Did I do it right? A wave of reluctance came over Kit. The last thing he wanted to do was get close to the magic circle. How would I know? Well, your father was a magician. I thought he might have taught you some of this, Ty said. Kit kicked at the edge of the water. Luminous sparks flew up. Actually, my dad kind of kept me away from learning real spells. But I know a little. He scuffed across the beach toward Ty, who was sitting with his legs crossed on the sand. Kit had often thought night and darkness seemed like Ty's natural environment. He disliked direct sunlight, and his pale skin looked as if it had never been burned. In moonlight, he shone like a star. With a sigh, Kit pointed at the glowing red ball Ty had gotten from the shadow market. The catalyst goes in the middle of the circle. Ty was already picking it up. Come sit next to me, he said. Kit knelt down as Ty started to place the objects into the ceremonial circle, murmuring in a low voice as he did so. He reached up, undid the chain of the locket, handed it to Kit. With a deep sense of dread, Kit placed the locket near the edge of the circle. Ty began to chant more loudly.
Abyssus abyssum, invocat invoce, cataractarum tuarum. Omnia excelsetua, et fluctus tui super, me transierunt.
Deep calls to deep in the voice of your waterfalls. All your whirlpools and waves have passed over me. As he chanted, one by one, the objects in the circle caught fire, like fireworks going off in a row. They burned with a clean white blaze without being consumed. A strong wind started to blow off the lake. It smelled of loam and grave dirt. Kit started to hear a clamor of voices and twisted around, staring. Was someone there? Had they been followed? But he saw no one. The beach was deserted. Do you hear that? He whispered. Ty only shook his head, still chanting. The lake shimmered, the water moving. Pale, white figures rose from the dark water. Many were in gear, some in more old-fashioned armor. Their hair flowed down and around them, translucent in the moonlight. They reached their arms out toward him, toward Ty, who could not see them. Their lips moved silently. This is really happening, Kit thought, chilled to the bone. Whatever tiny hope he'd had this wouldn't work had vanished. He turned to Ty, who was still chanting, spitting out the memorized words like machine gun fire.
Hic mortui we want. Hic mortui we want.
Ty, stop! His hands shot out, grabbed Ty's shoulders. He knew he shouldn't. Ty didn't like to be startled, but terror was fizzing in his blood like poison.
Ty, don't do this!
The Latin choked off mid-sentence. Ty stared at Kit, confused, his gray eyes darting from Kit's collarbone to his face and back down again.
What do you mean? I don't understand.
Don't do this! Don't raise her from the dead!
But I have to, Ty said.
His voice sounded stretched, like a wire pulled taut.
I can't
live without Livy.
Yes, you can, Kit whispered. You can. You think this will make your family stronger, but it will destroy them if you bring her back. You think you can't survive without Livy, but you can. We will go through it together.
Kit's face was cold. He realized he was crying.
I love you, Ty. I love you.
Ty's face went blank with surprise. Kit plowed on, regardless, hardly knowing what he was saying.
She's gone, Ty. She's gone forever. You have to get through this. Your family will help you. I will help you, but not if you do this. Not if you do this, Ty.
The blankness was gone from Ty's face, his mouth twisted, as if he were trying to hold in tears. Kit knew the feeling. He hated seeing it on Ty's face. He hated everything that was happening.
I have to get her back, Kit, Ty whispered. I have to.
He pulled away from Kit's grasp, turned back toward the circle, where the various objects were still burning. The air was full of the scent of char.
Ty!
Kit said, but Ty was already chanting Latin again, his hands outstretched to the circle.
Igni feroque excellentio ex animo.
Kit threw himself at Ty, knocking him onto the sand. Ty tumbled backward without a struggle, too surprised to defend himself. They rolled down the slight incline toward the water. They splashed into the shadows, and Ty seemed to come back to life. He shoved at Kit, elbowing him hard in the throat. Kit coughed and let go. He grabbed for Ty again, and Ty kicked at him. He could see Ty was crying. But even crying, he was a better fighter than Kit was. Though Ty looked fragile as moonbeams, he was a shadow hunter born and trained. He struggled free and darted up the sand toward the circle, thrusting his hand out to the fire.
Excellentio! Ex animo!
He shouted, panting.
Livia Blackthorn! Resurget! Resurget! Resurget!
The flame in the center of the circle turned black. Kit sank back on his heels, tasting blood in his mouth. It was over. The spell was done. The dark flames rose toward the sky. Ty stepped back, staring, as they roared upward. Kit, who had seen dark magic before, staggered to his feet. Anything could have gone wrong, he thought grimly. If they had to run, he'd knock Ty out with a rock, drag him away. The water of the lake began to ripple. Both boys turned to look, and Kit realized the shimmering dead were gone. There was only one transparent figure now, rising out of the water, her hair long and streaming silver. The outline of her face, her eyes, came clear. Her floating hair, a locket around her throat, the drifting white dress that didn't seem like something Livy would have chosen. Livy, Kit whispered. Ty ran to the edge of the lake. He stumbled, fell to his knees at the waterline as Libby's ghost made its way toward them across the water, scattering luminous sparks. She reached the banks of the lake. Her bare feet trailed in the glowing water. She looked down at Ty, her body transparent as a cloud, her expression unfathomably sad.
Why have you disquieted me?
She said in a voice as sorrowful as winter wind.
Livy,
Ty said. He reached a hand out as if he could touch her. His fingers passed through the skirt of her dress.
It's not really her,
Kit wiped blood from his face.
She's a ghost.
Relief battled with misery in his chest. She wasn't undead. But surely raising a ghost against its will wasn't a good idea either.
Why aren't you here? Said Ty, his voice rising. I did everything right. I did everything right.
The catalyst you used was corrupted. It wasn't strong enough to fully bring me back, Livy said. It might have other consequences as well, Ty.
But you can stay with me, right? You can stay with me like this, Ty interrupted.
The outlines of Livy's body blurred as she swayed toward her brother.
Is that what you want?
Yes. That's why I did all this,
Ty said. I want you to be with me in any way you can be. You were there with me before I was born, Livy. Without you, I just... There's nothing if you aren't there.
There's nothing if you aren't there. Pity and despair ripped through Kit. He couldn't hate Ty for this, but he would never mean anything to Ty, and never had. That much was clear.
I loved you, Ty. I loved you even when I was dead, said Livy's ghost. But you have upended the universe, and we will all pay for it. You've ripped a hole in the fabric of life and death. You don't know what you've done.
Tears ran down Livy's face and splashed into the water, individual glowing drops like sparks of fire.
You cannot borrow from death. You can only pay for it.
She vanished.
Livy!
Ty didn't scream the word so much as it was ripped from him. He curled up, hugging himself, as if desperate to keep his body from shattering apart. Kit could hear Ty crying, awful, dark sobs that sounded pulled out of him. An hour ago he would have moved heaven to make it stop. Now he was unable to take a step. His own pain, a searing agony that held him frozen in place. He looked up at the ceremonial circle. The flames were burning white again. The objects inside were beginning to be consumed. The velvet bag turned to ash. The tooth blackened. The chalk and myrrh destroyed. Only the necklace still gleamed whole and unharmed. As Kit watched, the letter from Thule caught fire and the words on the page flared up to burn a glowing black before vanishing.
I love you. I love you. I love you.
At the door of the guard prison, Drew paused, picks in hand. She was breathing hard from her climb up the hill. She hadn't taken the normal paths, but crept through the underbrush, staying out of sight. Her wrists and ankles were torn from the whiplash scratches of branches and thorns. She barely felt the pain. Now was the moment of reckoning. On the other side of this action, there was no turning back. No matter how young she was, if Horace and the others prevailed and learned what she'd done, she'd be punished. Julian's voice echoed in her ears. You were part of Livia's watch. Don't forget it. Livy wouldn't have hesitated, Drew knew. She would have hurtled forward, desperate to right any injustice she saw. She would never have held back. She would never have hesitated.
Livy, this is for you, my sister. I love you. I love you. I love you.
She went to work on the lock. The entrance to the Silent City was just as Emma remembered it. A barely marked trail passing through the corner of Brosselin Forest, surrounded by thick greenery. It was clear that few passed this way, and rarely. Her witchlight revealed a path almost unmarked by footsteps. She could hear the twitter of nightbirds and the movement of small animals among the trees. But something was missing from Brosselin. It had always been a place where one might have expected to see the glint of will-o'-the-wisps among the leaves, or hear the crackle of a campfire around which werewolves were gathered. There was something very present about its current silence, something that made Emma walk with extra care. The trees grew together more thickly as she reached the mountainside and found the door in among the rocks. It looked just as it had 3 years ago, pointed at the top and carved with the